Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, powered by FanDuel. College football on the horizon and some marquee matchups as the national landscape will begin to take shape this coming weekend. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider.
A lot of good games this weekend.
It's about damn time that we see rubber meet the road and some of these elite teams actually have to test their mettle against teams not hailing from the bottom of their respective leagues.
No doubt about it. A lot of rain in the forecast with this hurricane coming up the Gulf.
That's rain in the forecast is putting it mildly. I feel like every SEC total has been bet down a full touchdown, if not more, given what Mother Nature may dump on the entire Southeast this weekend.
Yes, that seems to be the case, and it looks like even though it is still on the board, the LSU game may change venues as well.
Yeah, that was the talk earlier as we record this Wednesday morning on Tuesday, talking about everybody packing up their stuff in Baton Rouge and heading up to Columbia, Missouri, a change in venue. I think, Payne, for that game, and I know it's not one that we're going to talk about in great detail, I'm going to be fascinated to see what odds makers elect to do with that number, given the discussion all season long about the value, especially in college, of home field. What is it worth? What is it not worth? I think that's going to be pretty telling, and then ultimately where that number does settle.
Absolutely, and it's kind of telling to see how many fans might actually be allowed in the stands. That's the bigger component to some of this. You know, go back last week, we're watching the Georgia game. And they're only allowed to have, what was it supposed to be, about 15,000 fans in the stands? And it looked
allegedly 15,000. Yeah, allegedly 15,000 fans in the stands. If I could bet, and I'm never going to get an official count, I'd happily go over and feel pretty confident with my wager.
Yes, I would say there was at least 50,000 people there. They were toppled on top of each other. That was interesting to me. So those are the kind of things that will change the home field advantage just a touch.
Yeah, and a hat tip to LSU, despite not getting the game played down there in Death Valley, peeling back some of the restrictions they had week one, opening up liquor sales. I guess when you lose as a 14-point favorite at home to Mississippi State week one, then you see Mississippi State lose to Arkansas the following week, you go, hey, we're throwing caution to the wind. We're going to do whatever we can to get the home field advantage back and the brown liquor flowing.
Yeah, you just need a different philosophy, I think, or a solid game plan on defense. Apparently, you want to go zone against Mike Leach's high-powered offense, not man. That was something LSU couldn't figure out at halftime, I guess.
Who knew that Chris Peterson, who'd laid the foundation for the last 17 years in the Apple Cup, LSU wasn't smart enough to follow that footage and go, hey, look, you know what? We're going to rush three. We're going to drop eight into coverage, and we're going to try and force countless turnovers. But either way, congrats to Arkansas, a long-suffering fan base that finally gets that elusive SEC victory. We'll see if they can handle a little bit of prosperity as things seem to be much more optimistic there, even with Felipe Franks as their quarterback, than they appeared 2 short weeks ago. And Payne, before we get into some of the biggest games on the docket, obviously for us this weekend, I want to cover the top 10. We've had a pretty positive response from a lot of our listenership about, hey, it's great when you guys talk bet the board top 10. We want to know what the thought process is behind some of it. And I think for this week, though, I mean, the first 7-8 spots, well, maybe number 8 we should talk about, but the first 7 largely unchanged for the most part.
Nothing's changed. So not a lot to talk about here. Still have Ohio State atop the Bet the Board top 10. Clemson, Alabama, Georgia with a great performance on Saturday evening against Auburn. That wasn't even close. Florida still at 5. Penn State, Notre Dame. Some question marks there about some player availability. Again, this week saw 16 guys out for Monday's practice as they look ahead to the Florida State game. I'm not sure. They might be able to field the walk-ons there and do okay against Florida State. But Notre Dame at 7, and then Wisconsin at 8. You seem intrigued and willing to talk about the Badgers.
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what Wisconsin does at the quarterback position. We know that the Badgers are a team that's not built on great quarterback play, but when you have Jack Cohn breaking his foot Saturday in practice, it clearly changes the dynamic for a team. A lot of people, myself included, thought could contend for a Big Ten West crown this year. We know the balance of power is still very much on the East, but when you look at the unbalanced schedule of sorts, let's see what the Badgers elect to do. I'll openly admit that I'm not exactly positive in terms of what they have on their depth chart. We do have a couple weeks before they'll start playing meaningful football towards the latter portion of October.
And then the shock, the one that everyone wanted to see. We did move Miami up a little bit during their bye week. They're number 9 right now, and I think we talked about this a little bit last year frequently, and then so far this year, basically 9 through 15 seems to interchange based upon obviously performance, strength of schedule. So Miami again fractionally sneaking into the top 10 this week at number 9.
And I will, of course, see the Canes in all of their glory. And if the U is truly back this coming Saturday when they go to take on Clemson as a 2-touchdown underdogs. But, of course, we won't play spoiler. That's one of the marquee matchups that we'll break down in greater detail. But if Miami surprised people at number 9, 10, I think number 10 is really going to blow some folks away.
I do want to say one thing, and I want to get your feedback on this.
That's always dangerous.
A couple weeks ago when we broke down Florida State Miami, how did you think I discussed that game? Because I got to tell you, I was digging through some things on the old social media the other day, and we weren't tagged in it. But apparently after that breakdown where I praised the Hurricanes for effectively going out and getting Rhett Lashley, and then the monologue I delivered on Florida State where I just said they have absolutely no talent, I was called an FSU homer in that game.
Sometimes, Payne, it's tough to shed that stigma. You know, over the couple of years, people know they come to you as the bastion of hope and light for Florida State football. And so even if you don't heap them with effusive praise and you say glowing things about their particular rival, people don't want to try and hear the truth. They only have tunnel vision and they go, oh, Payne's talking about Florida State. He clearly hates Miami.
Wild to see. Also pretty wild to see here, number 10. We finally moved BYU up just a tick here again. We had them around 12 or 13 last week. Some of these teams did not perform very well that were around that area. So you like what you've seen from Zach Wilson so far? He's been fantastic. Actually, shocking, it's him as a passer. Now, I know the defense and the schedules that they've played haven't been overly impressive, but when you look at Zach Wilson right now, 22% above expectation in terms of completion percentage. We knew he had that added element of his legs, but so far, Zach Wilson has been a fantastic passer.
Going to be real interesting to see what BYU truly becomes. We know they're massive favorites this weekend against UTSA, approaching 5 touchdowns. And their schedule, of course, has been a work in progress all season long. They do have a road day Friday, October 16th at Houston. And then when you look at the latter portion of the schedule, I think their biggest challenge will come Saturday, November 7th, now that Boise State is back and we're seeing the Mountain West going to go through a full conference schedule and play a couple of non-con games as well. That one becomes rather intriguing as the true test, because if BYU goes undefeated, let's not kid ourselves, they're not going to work their way into the college football playoff discussion by any stretch, but maybe we do have to consider them for a New Year's Six bowl game, and that'll give us a much better indication of where this program truly is and what their ceiling would have been should they have been able to play out their season schedule in a pre-COVID environment.
No doubt. And the one thing that I really like about BYU is that offensive line. They're just mauling people. And then Zach Wilson's taken that next step. So the offense seems pretty balanced. And at the college level, if you have a guy that can pass accurately, also use his legs, and you have this massive offensive line just plowing people around, it's a really, really good offense for the BYU Cougars.
And for those folks interested to see our most overrated and underrated teams, well, we're going to hold a little bit back. You're going to have to go to OutKick and check that article out. Our partners there more than happy to circulate our article post. It'll also come with a secondary best bet as well. But let's just say it's got a distinctly Big 12 flavor, easy for me to say, in the overrated and underrated portion of the program. All right, Payne, to the games this coming weekend. And since we go in betting index order, the marquee game of the weekend will kick us off. And that, of course, is the Clemson game where they'll play host to Miami. You're looking at Clemson, a 14-point home favorite, number down a little bit at FanDuel. Total on this game, 63.5. Now, if you look at the weather forecast, a 90% chance of rain, Hurricane Delta Category 2. This total, though, is actually ticked up compared to what we've seen everywhere else. First top 10 matchup at Clemson since the Tigers actually hosted Lamar Jackson back in 2016. When you look at Clemson's recent run of success, they've not only been dominant straight up, but also at the betting window. 15-5 against the spread the last 20 league games, and that does include a non-cover last weekend against Virginia. Meanwhile, Miami, well, they haven't exactly used their week off to pay dividends. 0-5 straight up and against the number the last five times they've had extra time to prepare. And when you look at the two most recent meetings between these programs, one-sided probably doesn't do it justice. Clemson has outscored the Canes 96-3. Payne, we know what Clemson has turned themselves into, a juggernaut of sorts by college football standards. I can't imagine Dabo Swinney, when he describes their performance last weekend against Virginia as ugly, has made practice all that easy on his players, either on the offensive or defensive side, knowing that Rhett Lashley, De'Ara King, and that high-powered Canes offense rolls into town.
So you kind of took a jab at the Hurricanes in their bye week, and I'm going to stand up for them. I'm interested to see.
Homer, this is what I get from a Florida State homer standing up for Miami, trying to get a Tiger to change his stripes. I see what you're doing here.
I am actually pretty interested to see what Rhett Lashley cooked up during the bye. I think the bye week early in the season could be an advantage with the current landscape we're dealing with. You know, new OC, new quarterback, shortened offseason with COVID. You now have three games under your belt. You use that bye week to not clean up what you're already doing. But my feeling is Lashley's going to implement some things that he didn't have time to do this offseason. So I would expect a few wrinkles that we haven't seen from Miami's offense. Now, I think there's probably a lot of questions with both Miami's offense and Clemson's defense that we'll have a better understanding of after this game, unless it's just an absolute monsoon and it's one of those things where it's just you can't really tell much from either unit. And I'm not trying to be overly critical because I understand nobody looks like really good right now or up to the level we expect from some of these programs. Clemson's defense, we knew they got hit on that side of the ball. 51% of their production returned this season. Key guys lost at each level. Early on, we've also seen some miscommunication at times. So Brett Venables needs to clean that up. We know he likes to be diverse in his coverage and his scheme. So communication will be big here. I think everyone knows how I feel about, you know, Rhett Lashley, but this is going to be the ultimate test. You know, we loved that hire, Todd, but when you look at this game and you look at how Miami's played offensively, it's going to need to be a combination of everything that we've seen in each of these individual games. You know, we saw against UAB, Hurricanes score 31 points. They do it with a 38% success rate, lived on the explosive. Same thing against Louisville, 47 points with a 32% success rate. You mentioned the rain could be falling here. Somehow in that Louisville game, just an 18% rushing success rate. You'd obviously need to clean that up in a game like this where you're not able to throw it downfield as much. But if you look at Lashley and King and the Canes offense, because they've lived on that explosive play the first 2 weeks, and we know it's kind of tough to sustain that when you're going up against, I would say, better than the talent that Miami has or similar, you're going to have to be able to go and be efficient down to down. And that was actually the one thing that surprised me when I saw that tweet, Todd, was that Thursday podcast we did before the FSU game, regardless of result, FSU felt the same exact way we did. Because Adam Fuller in the Seminoles defense said, hey, we're going to play three defensive linemen. We're going to drop eight. We're going to force Miami to methodically move the ball down the field. That backfired, obviously. But the approach didn't work because FSU doesn't have much talent. And they don't communicate, and they're learning their fourth defensive system in as many years. And so the communication was piss poor. So if you look at that game, King and the Canes offense had their best performance by far. Miami was successful, moving it methodically down the field. 52% success rate on offensive snaps. So I think this game needs to be a combination of both to pull off the upset. You know, Miami needs to be efficient down to down. They're going to have to also hit a few explosives over the top. And, you know, you're going to have to rely on a receiver group that I think does have some question marks. But if Miami can't be efficient on some of those early downs, I think that hinders things. You know, I'm looking at this Miami offensive line, and from what I have seen so far, they've been fantastic. You know, you basically Lashley is hiding this offensive line. And so it's been improved, right? You had some transfers. The metrics say they're third best in the country in pass block efficiency. This is one of the instances where the metrics lie. Miami's O-line right now is improved because of three things. De'Aaron King's mobility, the tempo of the offense increasing, which doesn't allow defensive linemen to sub out, so it's always easier to block tired guys. And then you're looking at what Lashley's doing. He's getting the ball out with King significantly quicker. So that's why this offensive line is improved. But if you can't run the ball in early downs, that's going to all change. Because right now, when I look at this dichotomy, 2.5 seconds is kind of universally considered the mark of getting the ball out on time. Last year, Miami's quarterbacks that played the most snaps released the ball in 2.7 seconds. De'Aaron King's doing it in 2.3. So that offensive line, I don't think, is as good. So that would be trouble here if you're not able to run the ball in early downs, Todd.
And I mean, you look at De'Aaron King's number, he's averaging more than 5 yards after contact, talking about 15 yards a scramble hit. We knew about his mobility and how valuable he was going to be, trying to mask some of those deficiencies there that you talked about. Cameron Harris has shown a little bit of spark and burst in terms of running the football. But when you look at Clemson on the defensive side, Payne, they give up more than 400 yards against Virginia, including the Cavaliers, allowing them to convert 4 out of 5 on fourth down. I don't know if I'm as optimistic as some people that say, hey, look, they played a running quarterback last week, and it's going to allow them to prepare, because I don't see Brennan Armstrong as a spitting image of De'Aaron King by any stretch of the imagination. And we know this Clemson team is extremely young at some of the key positions you need to be successful slowing down Miami, specifically at linebacker and, of course, in the secondary.
Absolutely. So you kind of hit that on the head. Certainly Brennan Armstrong isn't a De'Aaron King clone by any stretch of the imagination. He went for 89 yards last week, but maybe it will allow them to change some things defensively. Maybe Venables goes to a little more vanilla defense. It's tough to play press man coverage, you know, against a quarterback like King. You can't have your defenders with your backs to the quarterback, so maybe that at least fundamentally changes how, you know, Clemson will defend Miami, having seen Brennan Armstrong go nuts. You mentioned Miami's excellent tight ends. It's going to be on Mike Jones Jr. to handle that responsibility and kind of limit what the tight end group does. When you look at this game and why, again, it's really important that Miami has some success on early downs on the ground, is because De'Aaron King, as good as he has been, just a 36% success rate on known passing situations. He is a capable passer, but no one's going to confuse him with an elite passer. So you got to force King to pass in these known passing situations. I think that'll hinder Miami's offense a little bit. Right now, if you look, just based upon what we have been saying this entire time about, you know, not being overly efficient on early downs, the Canes' average distance to go on third down is 8.2 yards. I don't know if you're going to be able to survive that against Clemson. You sure can against UAB, Louisville, and a horrific Florida State defense, but not against Clemson, even if they are young and inexperienced.
When you look at the other side of the ball, we know that Miami's defensive line had a couple of key opt-outs, but they really haven't missed a beat. Quincy Roche and Jalen Phillips have been an absolute load up front for the Canes' defensive line. When you go against a quarterback as talented as Trevor Lawrence, ultimately you're going to have to do some things to be able to confuse him, get him off his spot, and change the dynamic of what they want to do. Last year, we saw Trevor Lawrence really struggle without his main weapons. Justin Ross, of course, was lost before this season even got going, but it doesn't appear to have that had the same negative impact on the Clemson passing game, as they're top 10 in yards per play to start the season, number one in the ACC in passing yards, completion percentage, and yards per pass. Now, the offense may need time, Payne, to work on some of their communication and identifying the defensive schemes they're encountering, but when we look at this particular side, does Miami have enough to get stops? They're not going to have to do it every single series, but consistently enough to get the ball back for their offense, set them up in decent field position, and ultimately stay inside of the 2-touchdown tariff.
You initially started with Miami's defensive line, and I think that's where it starts, up front. That's going to decide how things go on this side of the ball. Even with Russo opting out, Miami's strength is their D-line. You still have Clemson breaking in 4 new starters along their offensive line. But, you know, when you look at Clemson, they've played well so far, but it's been a drop-off from last season. The push hasn't been there. in the run game. You're looking at guys like Jackson Carman and Jordan McFadden. They've been pretty good in pass protection at the tackle spots through three games. And they're going to obviously be tasked with shutting down Roche and Phillips. The inside, I think, is where Miami really needs to eat. You know, Harrison Hunt and Silvera, they've been good getting after the quarterback. That's where Clemson's offensive line, to me, looks most vulnerable. I went back and watched the Virginia game last night, then started digging into some of the interior line metrics. And that's where Miami really needs to make some hay there. The things Miami has done well defensively, you know, past the D line, they haven't really been tested. So I don't know what the linebacker unit looks like. Don't really know what the secondary looks like. They haven't truly been tested. If you look at UAB and FSU, they're both outside the top 100 and top 50 in offensive efficiency. Louisville's offense is the best Miami's faced so far. They had a 48% offensive success rate, 6.4 yards per play. Both those numbers are well above the national average. So this becomes a little bit of a different beast here, obviously, against Trevor Lawrence and Travis Etienne. They're significantly better than anything Louisville has on offense. So that's kind of the one game I tried to focus in on and see if I could find anything. And Louisville did have success. And you look last week against the Virginia defense. It's a fringe top 25 defense. Lawrence and Etienne had a combined total EPA of 42.1. Those two guys, between pass attempts, runs from each, and receptions, had 63 touches of value. They averaged over two-thirds of a point per touch anytime they touched it. So it's a banana land number, right, when you're talking about a Power 5 defense in a conference game. So those two guys have really just shouldered the load of this offense. This is a game where I think we see Trevor Lawrence use his legs a bit more in these crucial situations. All these quarterbacks, right, when it's needed, they're going to use these added elements of the legs. When you're playing the Citadel, not really needed. I would think Tony Elliott, Clemson's OC, would be wise to use Miami's eagerness to get upfield against them, let them over-pursue. We know Manny Diaz hasn't sent as many blitzes this season, you know, to protect the back end, but there's still, you know, a little bit of an itchy trigger finger there. Have, you know, make Miami pay when they send pressure. Use some of these you know, throwback situations to Etienne that could work. The one thing that I have seen so far is sometimes, you know, you see this Hurricanes defensive line. They are hell-bent on getting up the field. You can really sneak some things behind them. The other thing is, you know, Miami's off defensive line, they have done a good job making some havoc. 24% of run plays have been stopped at or behind the line of scrimmage. But that's led to some gashers. Miami's given up 4 yards per rush attempt, nearly a full yard more than last season. I would expect Bubba Bolden to help in run support, maybe focus on limiting Etienne, catching balls out of the backfield as well. I'm just interested to see how Miami's secondary looks here. Now, if there's rain and there's weather, maybe that's an assist there, but they haven't faced a quarterback that can actually throw the forward pass yet. You're looking at Malik Cunningham. You're looking at James Blackman. UAB's Tyler Johnston. None of those guys are going to be confused for Trevor Lawrence. Two of those three quarterbacks have already been benched a month into the season for better options. Okay? You know, you're looking at Trevor Lawrence here. He's averaging 10.2 yards per pass attempt and a 64% passing success rate in non-garbage time situations. Through three games, Trevor Lawrence is graded out better than Joe Burrow did last season through three games. Now, obviously, you mentioned some of the weapons outside, Todd. To me, again, I go back, watch some of this stuff. Past Amari Rodgers, there's some question marks. And we've been hearing now about Joseph Ngata, you know, how he's this absolute beast, but he's been dealing with this core muscle issue. He needs to be a factor this week. But I think this is the week. If the weather holds up, we're going to find out what Miami's secondary is because they haven't been tested yet. And just based upon how Manny Diaz has played, Todd, not sending as much pressure, not sending as much blitzes, it leads me to believe he's not overly confident in the back half of his defense.
Going to be one hell of a game. You hope Mother Nature at least holds back a little bit. Now, I know obviously you have to factor that in your handicapping, but you'd love to see these two teams on full display as we begin to get a better idea of exactly how the pecking order will shape up in the ACC with two teams that a lot of people had high expectations for coming into this season. Another game that'll go a little bit under the radar pane in the ACC, Virginia Tech and North Carolina, kind of in that second tier. And you're looking at North Carolina, a 4.5-point home favorite as they welcome in the Virginia Tech Hokies. Total on this game, 59.5 at FanDuel. And when we look at VT so far this season, there may not be a team in college football other than Notre Dame more heavily impacted by COVID than what they've had to deal with, not only from some of their starters and their two deep, but also missing head coaches and coaches and coordinators. And you look at Virginia Tech, I mean, this is a team that's thrived actually as an underdog. The last 12 times they've been installed as a pup, 6-6 straight up, 8-4 against the number. They've really owned this series recently, covering 6 of the last 7 against the Tar Heels. But the last two meetings, Virginia Tech won by a combined 5 points, including an overtime thriller last year. When we look at North Carolina on the other side, a lot of expectations coming into this year. Everyone believing that Mack Brown and Sam Howell were going to elevate this program to another level. We haven't quite seen that in wins against Syracuse and a workman-like victory where they had to outlast Boston College last week. But when we try and figure out North Carolina, do we feel the market has more or less caught up to some of those preseason expectations, seeing that they're less than a touchdown favorite here?
I would say that's probably right. There was a lot of hype coming into the season for UNC. There's a couple of us, though, I think, that needed to actually see it before we completely believed it. But the talent is certainly upgraded there. The one thing I will say about UNC's offense, it feels like there's only one direction but up. You know, after no spring practices and then this random 3-week layoff, to me it's pretty clear that UNC and Phil Longo's offense is out of form right now. They're not in rhythm. I think the question becomes, and it's difficult to gauge, is will we see a different North Carolina offense this week? I would think so. Now, there's always been this, you know, boom or bust potential because we know Longo likes to hunt the big play and send them, you know, his receivers on like a slew of go balls. But right now, Sam Howell hasn't completed a single deep pass this season, and I think that's skewing some things. Last year, Howell averaged almost 3.5 deep ball completions per game. You can see he's not on the same page as his receivers right now. He's staring down some receivers at times. You know, Howell's having trouble getting the ball to one of his top playmakers too, and Daz Newsome. 3 catches on the season, but even worse, just 6 total targets. This is a guy who had 1,000 yards receiving and double-digit touchdowns last season. So the passing game isn't quite there yet. We talk about it all the time. That's the component of the offense that requires a little bit more work in the offseason, and they just haven't had that time yet. So hopefully it changes a little bit this week. You got to get Daz Newsome the ball, figure out how to do it. The thing is, we know last week the Hokies had 21 players unavailable against Duke. Their top 4 defensive backs were out. They also were missing their starting linebacker, and their entire coaching room seems like it got hit with COVID as well. Vautech hasn't had the same play caller on the defensive side this season yet. So for as much as UNC's pass game is struggling, the Hokies need, I think, a healthy secondary. UNC probably gets back on track through the air. So that's something to monitor a little bit here, is see which guys are back in that Hokie secondary. I think what's kept them afloat so far, though, Todd, is the ground game. And it's a bit interesting. I think we expected some improvement there. UNC was 77th in rushing success rate last season. But when you're looking right now, Michael Carter, Javon Williams, they look like a nice tandem. Even Sam Howell pitching in with his legs a little bit, averaging 7 yards a carry on designed runs and scrambles. But I think this is a little bit of a different animal, right? You're going against a Hokies defense right now that is certainly improved. They got a bunch of guys back this season. The D-line has been dominant so far. They have been really disruptive, creating some havoc plays, 32 negative plays right now created by the Hokies defense in 2 games. So I think UNC's ground game probably face its, you know, toughest challenge to date so far. Let's see how, Sam Howell performs under pressure as well. That's another area where he hasn't done very well, with him not being on the same page as his receiver. He's 45th among FBS quarterbacks with at least 100 dropbacks and passer rating under pressure. You know, this season right now, you're looking, the O-line has allowed Sam Howell to be pressured on 31% of his dropbacks through 2 games. And, you know, you're looking at, you know, his completion percentage, 37% adjusted completion percentage and a 45 passer rating when pressured. That's going to be the key to this game. Even Sam Howell, we think about this guy, and we just talked about some of his rushing numbers there. He hasn't been overly mobile inside the pocket. He's been sacked on 26% of his dropbacks, which is a, you know, kind of an alarmingly high rate there. So this will be really important, that Vautech gets after Sam Howell. They shut the ground game down. And then you're going to need some health on the back end. So that's the biggest thing. But what we're seeing so far is UNC's inability right now to hit the big play through the air. The O-line and Sam Howell have just taken a slew of negative plays. They've also been penalized a ton. So I think those are the three things that we need to look for in this matchup. UNC's average distance to go on third down right now, whopping 8.6 yards. If it looks like that again this weekend, maybe the Hokies pull the upset.
It's an interesting football game for a variety of reasons. I mean, you talk about how Virginia Tech has performed in the face of adversity. It'd be easy to crater in the fetal position or curl up in the fetal position and go, no, look, we don't have our players. We're going to go out there and just put our best foot forward. But it's been this Virginia Tech offense that has actually been a breath of fresh air for their defense as they racked up 324 yards on the ground against Duke, averaging right around 6.5 yards per carry. That on the heels of a 300-plus yard rushing performance against NC State, where they averaged nearly 8 yards a touch. You look at Khalil Herbert, the Kansas transfer, and his big play potential. 300 yards through two games, averaging more than a first down every single time he gets his hands on it. And for Virginia Tech, you hope the light at the end of the tunnel is the return of your starting quarterback in Hendon Hooker, who finished last season with over 1,500 yards, 13 touchdowns, and only 2 picks. The talk was that he was going to be available last week. There was a lot of speculation in terms of why he did or didn't play. Braxton Burmeister, of course, goes out there, 9 of 24, 163 yards, 15 carries, 54 yards. We'll call him a glorified game manager at the college football level. But if Hooker's back out there, it adds an element to Virginia Tech's offense that they haven't had. And quite frankly, Payne, when I look at North Carolina on the defensive side, we thought they were going to be improved. We know the recruiting has been significantly upgraded. But when you take on Syracuse, which has no offensive line to protect Tommy DeVito week one, you follow it up the last week against Boston College, and the Eagles completely abandoned the run game, whether it was by design or because they didn't feel comfortable in their offensive line. You have to think that Tech should be able to control the trenches and continue some of that rushing success against a North Carolina defense that's really been untested in terms of containing the edge.
So Justin Fuente has smartly not named a starting quarterback for Saturday yet, although I think we can probably guess by him calling Hendon Hooker full go that will be the case. We know Burmeister started both games, played all of the Duke game, but Hendon Hooker was number one on the depth chart, right? And he was back with the team last week. You mentioned that he beat Burmeister out in camp, but I think he was obviously dealing with the COVID thing, and he was available last week. I just think it was a conditioning question mark there. So listen, I think Hooker's probably ready this week. Wouldn't shock me to see both guys play. But listen, you're looking at VTech. They're 2-0, but you can see why Burmeister was beat out in camp. He struggles to throw the football. 51%.
I know why he transferred out of Oregon. He couldn't get the job done.
Yes. So, you look, even in like perfect situations, when Burmeister's kept clean, he's completing less than 50% of his passes, has a 74 passer rating. And that's against two defenses outside the top 70 in efficiency. So Hendon Hooker is a massive upgrade here. You talked about VaTech leaning on their ground game. Khalil Herbert right now has been the bulk of VaTech's offense. 10 explosive runs in two games. His total rushing EPA last week was 13.7 on 26 total carries, meaning every time the Hokies handed Herbert the ball, that singular play was expected to turn into more than half a point on the scoreboard. He was absolutely electric. Of running backs with at least 20 carries, Herbert has the best elusive rating in college football. Obviously a small sample size, but he has been fantastic. So, when you look ahead to this matchup against UNC, I do think the Hokies have some success. I think, again, you kind of hinted at this. It looks great on paper for UNC's defense. They've only allowed 2 yards per carry. And we are projecting a little bit of a tick down from the Tar Heels defensively coming into the season, especially at defensive line. And you hit this perfectly. UNC's played 2 offenses right now. In Syracuse, 102nd in the country in offensive efficiency, dead last in getting ahead of schedule. So the Orange aren't much of a measuring stick. Boston College's offense, 40th in offensive efficiency. UNC, if you really break down that game, they survived on red zone stops where they held Jerkovich and BC to 3 points on 3 of their 5 trips into the money zone each time. So 9 total points there on 3 of the 5 trips. This, to me, is a step up in class for the Tar Heels defense. The other possibility here is what it means for VaTech to potentially get Hendon Hooker back. And, you try to talk to a lot of sophisticated football minds outside of the gambling space, right? Like, I think we have the gambling stuff, you know, pretty well covered. We have a lot of the metrics, but you start to talk to some of these coaches and players, and the one thing that kind of comes back every time I do in regards to the quarterback position is how well quarterbacks perform when there's no pressure. That is a reflection of their floor. How well quarterbacks perform under pressure represents the potential ceiling. And last season, of the quarterbacks that had at least 100 dropbacks, only one quarterback had a better passer rating under pressure than Hendon Hooker. That guy is currently starting for the Cincinnati Bengals right now.
He's pretty good, that guy starting for the Bengals.
So, you know, having Hendon Hooker back not only, I think, provides, you know, probably a little more burst in the ground game, but I think he's a significantly better passer too. So that's going to open some things up. If Herbert's killing it on the ground right now without a threat of pass, obviously some of his numbers are unsustainable, but there are going to be a lot more open areas for Herbert to run if you have a threat of a pass here. So something to watch for here is, if Hendon Hooker gets the snaps, is the offense more balanced? And, you know, while I think UNC's secondary was poised for a massive tick up this season because they finished 74th in passing success rate defense last year, terrible. But the Tar Heels are going to be down two starters. Bryce Watts, we know, opted out. And then you had a key cog in Miles Wolfolk, deemed academically ineligible prior to the BC game. There are also two other depth guys in UNC's secondary that opted out. So Hendon Hooker back might be able to take a little bit more advantage of that situation there in the Tar Heel secondary.
Serious question. How little do you have to do academically at North Carolina to be deemed academically ineligible, given what that program has gone through? Or does basketball just, are they given a lot more leeway than what you're given on the football field?
I'm going to keep trending in the right direction of not being an FSU homer, so I'm not going to speculate on other ACC schools' academic policies.
Well, we know Florida State's rather lenient in there, so I mean, either way, North Carolina may be a cut above. Should be one hell of a football game, though, as we try and figure out who these two teams are and exactly where they will ultimately end up in that ACC pecking order, if either of them are going to be a viable threat to dethroning Clemson, a team that has had this league under a stranglehold over the last handful of seasons, which provides the perfect segue to a game in Dallas that's lost pain, how do we say, quite a bit of its luster, given results of the earlier weeks so far this season, where it's the Oklahoma Sooners taking on the Texas Longhorns. And you're looking at Oklahoma, a 2.5-point favorite at FanDuel. Total in this game, 72.5. Weather at the Texas State Fair expected to be 90 degrees and sweltering. This game obviously provides an inside track typically to a conference title. Instead, this season it takes on more of an elimination game feel. Oklahoma will enter the contest ranked outside the top 25. For the first time since 2016, you look at the Longhorns, they've actually had a ton of success at the betting window, covering 7 of the last 8 against their rival. But the last time Oklahoma was this short of a favorite, you have to go all the way back to 2012. And while we can heap all the praise we want in Oklahoma and for how good they've been within the league, going 18-4 straight up the last 22 league games, just 7-14-1 against the number. But the Sooners, much like their Longhorn counterparts, apparently felt the need to hold team meetings and have these come-to-Jesus moments on the heels of last weekend's loss. Oklahoma is, in my opinion, a little bit more concerning when you consider the fact that they lost the week before to Kansas State. Meanwhile, Texas losing outright to TCU. Payne, I'm not even sure where to go to try and start an effective handicap on this particular game, but I guess we can look at Texas's offense that was inconsistent at best, with Sam Ehlinger bouncing balls all over the yard last week against TCU, against an Oklahoma defense who apparently thinks you only have to play three quarters in major college football.
Have you heard what they're calling this game?
No, I have not.
Apparently, fans of Texas and Oklahoma are calling this the Red River Recession. So, fans are not happy, obviously, with the results of last week's games.
Hey, you win this football game, you have a first class trip booked for the Alamo Bowl, you know, right before New Year's Eve. You're in good shape.
There you go. You know, the Longhorns offense right now is interesting. You know, I don't know what to expect there. Sam Ehlinger, obviously, the engine to this team. You mentioned, you know, he kind of took his leadership role to a new level after the TCU loss, held the team meeting on Sunday where apparently he went off on just about everybody, including himself, but he dug into teammates and said that, we just need to be better disciplined. We need to have more focus. apparently the meeting was called the Brutal Truth Challenge. And Ellinger came away saying, not all leaders are liked. So it'll be interesting to see the impact this meeting potentially had. I think Sam is respected enough, liked enough, that you probably think this meeting has a positive impact and it's not to be taken negatively. We'll see. But a lot of this, I think, you know, when you look at Texas' offense, is on Sam himself. He has been poor by his standards. He's grading out worse than he was last season. His accuracy, as you alluded to, is down. You start to wonder if he's 100% healthy. Partly why we saw steam on TCU last week, taking that number down from plus 13 to 10. Sam Ellinger was a little bit banged up. Let's put it that way. He was limited in practice last week, virtually the entire week. And you look, the first three quarters of the TCU game, 43% of Ellinger's passes were charted as being uncatchable. So you don't know if he's 100% healthy or not in this one. I would think he's healthier than he was last week. But the one thing that I kind of dug into here is Ellinger only ran the ball 8 times against TCU. That was the lowest number of rushes against a Power 5 opponent for Ellinger since October 13th, 2018 versus Baylor. So it kind of just leads me to believe here he might not be 100%. Hopefully he's feeling better this week. There's obviously going to be a lot of opportunities going against the Sooners defense. Alex Grinch has his work cut out for him, I think, this season. It'd be one thing, you know, if Grinch had like one area of his defense to fix, but they've been beaten up across the board. Even last week against Iowa State, Oklahoma gives up 10.7 yards per pass play. Breece Hall kills him on the ground along with the rest of the Cyclones running backs. They had a 57% success rate on the ground. So you go back to the drawing board and you're like, shit, can't stop the run, can't stop the pass. Right now, Oklahoma's secondary, the three cornerbacks that have played the most snaps, they've allowed at least a 105 passer rating when targeted. We saw Lincoln Riley insinuate that this was going to be a really physical week of practice, that Oklahoma is going to be working on tackling because they're currently the second worst tackling team in the country right now. This just feels like a game, Todd, where if you can potentially limit the explosiveness, you hold to a few field goals, you've done your job as a defense. Field goals are wins defensively. A grand slam, I guess, would be if you could force a turnover, gain an extra possession for your offense. But down to down, I think both defenses are going to struggle a little bit in this one.
Well, I mean, forcing turnovers, I mean, that's the white whale for the Oklahoma defense.
Yes.
I mean, this team can't force turnovers to save their lives. They can't win the turnover battle as a result, which is even more remarkable given the success we see from the Sooners. You mentioned their inability to tackle. I mean, that was on full display in giving up 14 points in the loss in Ames against Iowa State. They gave up 17 points in the fourth quarter against Kansas State over the last 2 weeks. One of the worst fourth quarter defenses in terms of preventing points. You mentioned Sam Ellinger taking on the role of leadership, whether he's loved or respected in that Texas locker room. Oklahoma did some of their own. It's so soul searching, so to speak. I mean, the theme of their team meeting was focus and not worrying about any thoughts and feelings from outside noise. Like we said, it was described as a coming to Jesus meeting for the players that have been staying up late on social media the night before the game. Let's just say, Payne, that's not a recipe for success. I don't think that helps you win college football games. And one source apparently shared that Ronnie Perkins told the team that if you want to be focused, you need a rest, and that means zero social media late at night. I don't know, what do you have to do? Do you take away their cell phones? Do you take away their laptops when they're in a team hotel or anything that goes into it? But when you look at this Sooners team...
I know you're joking about that.
No, I'm not.
I sleep significantly better when I place my phone far away from my bed. I end up going to sleep much earlier, and it's been helpful.
Well, that's because you shouldn't be sliding into people's Instagram DMs at 2 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast.
Yeah, I don't do that.
Okay. When we look at the Oklahoma Sooners, this is a team that's clearly lacked leadership. But you look at this team offensively, Spencer Rattler, he's going to bear the brunt of it given the consistency we've seen from the quarterback position. But I don't know if he's necessarily the problem. He's just committing those timely mistakes that we didn't grow accustomed to from Jalen Hurts and, of course, Kyler Murray before him. But if you look at some of the numbers, he had 3 touchdowns dropped and 5 of his 11 incompletions were dropped as well. Payne, Oklahoma's offense should have plenty of success against a Texas defense that, healthy or not, clearly isn't that much better than the addition we saw last year.
No. And listen, we broke down the Sooners last week, Todd. We have another data point in a game under, you know, their belt that we can assess here. everything we discussed heading into the Iowa State preview offensively was pretty spot on. The Sooners offense started hot again. So it's like no surprise there, nearly a point per minute the first 18 minutes of the game. Lincoln Riley's script, it's tough to beat, okay? And if you look, Oklahoma averaged 10 yards per play and a 75% success rate in the first quarter, similar to the game against Kansas State. It started to dwindle down as the game went on. That trended poorly, 4.2 yards per play in both the third and fourth quarters. Matt Campbell made some adjustments, better than Lincoln Riley did, and the Cyclones defense did a good enough job from that point forward after the first quarter to make life a little bit more difficult on Spencer Rattler. And, you know, you hit this perfectly. This isn't on Spencer Rattler. The guy's completion percentage is 15% above expectation through three games. There just isn't much around him on offense that's contributing consistently. I think there are some things that Rattler can do better, believe it or not. And we talked about last week that dichotomy of when Spencer plays within the offense and gets the ball out on time rather than improvising. The gap in production widened significantly in the Iowa State game as well. And if you look at this, just to rehash on it, because it widened so much, I want to talk about it again. When Rattler releases the ball within the confines of Lincoln Riley's offense and gets it out on time, he's got a 135 passer rating, he's completing 88% of his passes, and he has zero interceptions. When Rattler starts to improvise and hold on to the ball for more than 2.5 seconds, passer rating is 24 points lower, completion percentage decreases 25%. All of Rattler's interceptions, all four of them, have come when releasing the ball after 2.5 seconds, including the two crucial picks that ended the Sooners' fate, you know, against Kansas State and then last week against Iowa State. If Rattler gets the ball out on time against this Texas defense, they're probably not going to get any stops, right? Like, Oklahoma is going to be tough to stop, even with, right, you know, without help from Texas' defense. I don't really love the production around Rattler across the board, right? Like, anyone not named Rattler needs to wake up. The offensive line, not doing their job moving guys around. Against Iowa State, Sooners averaged 1.8 yards before contact on design runs. We know the running back room this offseason, Todd, took a hit. Trey Sermon transferred to Ohio State. Kennedy Brooks left. Oklahoma's offensive line has to be better because right now it seems like everything's on Spencer Rattler. You're looking at, you know, the wide receiver group, not very good. Running rates are down, so there aren't a lot of balance. That's the one thing Lincoln Riley has done pretty well, right? Like, he's aware of what's going on here. That's one thing I know a lot of Oklahoma fans are like, oh, you know, Lincoln Riley's been terrible. He's cognizant of what's going on. Like, he's a smart guy, right? Running rates are down, rushing success rates down, so he's throwing it more. This is a get-right game, though, I would think, against Texas. You can attack the Longhorns defensive unit virtually, I would think, anywhere. Chris Ash has his hands full here. The secondary has had issues, right? I like Max Duggan. I like Bowman. Spencer Rattler is a different animal, right? Like, Texas continues right now when you're looking. They give up explosive plays in the back end. TCU had three receivers, average over 20 yards a reception. I don't know if the Sooners receiver group is very good, but it's probably good enough to take advantage of the Longhorn secondary. One thing that we need to see improvement on, though, when we talk about Spencer Rattler's completion percentage above expectation, it's 15% above. The receivers aren't helping him out at all. You know, you're looking right now, this is a receiver group that avoided 4 total tackles last week. They need to be better after the catch. You're looking at tackling issues again for Texas as well. We talked about that last week, needed to clean it up against TCU. It wasn't. Right now, the Longhorns are the third worst tackling team in the entire country. So we have the second worst and the third worst going against each other. Which team tackles better, I think, sounds stupid, right, and obvious. Which team tackles better might actually win this game. But that's going to be the case when you're looking at these two defenses. I think Rattler's good enough. Then he needs some help from the ground game. The receivers need to take a step up, you know, put some responsibility on their backs as well because Rattler's doing everything for them. Avoid some tackles. We know if the Sooners can't avoid tackles after the catch this week, there's probably a problem there with this receiver group. So we just need the drops, as you mentioned, have also been an issue. You're looking at the top two receivers. They have over a 12% drop rate through the season at this point. So Rattler needs some help. probably is going to, you know, have a get right game here against this Texas defense, I would think.
Before we close the book on this particular game, when you look at the number, both side and total paint, accurate reflection of where these two teams are right now. Obviously, we're trying to figure out which stock may have bottomed out. You'd have to think that Oklahoma probably more devalued than any team in the country, given the back-to-back losses that have not exactly been a hallmark or staple of the Lincoln Riley era since taking over in Norman.
It's so tough to gauge because, you know, Oklahoma could have easily won both games, led by a wide margin against Kansas State before blowing it, led again last week early on in that game, even late. We're up a touchdown, couldn't hold on to it. So what does this look like if they're 3-0? From Texas's perspective, they probably don't deserve the Texas Tech win. But, you know, you cross the goal line late there and Ingram doesn't fumble, you're probably winning that game. So I think Texas is right where they should be at 2-1. What was the look ahead line on this game? I believe it was Oklahoma -6.5 this offseason.
I was going to say, it was definitely below a touchdown. I think I saw as low as 4.5 in some locations, as high as 6.5 in others.
Yeah. So it was one of those things where some opened at 6.5, some opened at 4.5. I believe it came down a little bit to 3.5, but, you know, obviously a valuable number. And we're looking at this game this week with Oklahoma between 1.5 and a 2-point favorite. So, you know, from that perspective, it seems like perception is a little bit lower on Oklahoma than coming into the season.
Going to be very interesting as both these teams had eyes on the prize in terms of winning a league championship. One of those seasons will be drastically derailed even further come Saturday with a loss against one of their most bitter rivals. Final big game breakdown of today's show, Payne, takes us to lovely College Station, Texas, where the Texas A&M Aggies will welcome in the Florida Gators. You're looking at Florida, a 6.5-point favorite at FanDuel. Total on the game, 57.5. Of course, very different results last weekend. Florida, a little bit of a misleading final, 38-24 victory against South Carolina. A game they did hold a 24-point lead, though, going into the final stanza. Meanwhile, on the other side, Texas A&M outclassed from basically the opening snap against the Alabama Crimson Tide. Sure, they erased an early 14-0 deficit, but that game was never truly competitive. Kyle Trask has looked every bit the part of a Heisman contender, at least through the first two games. Actually grew up a stone's throw, or a pretty long stone's throw away, from College Station in Marvel, Texas, about 2 hours away. Backed up De'Aaron King in high school, and the storyline here is that apparently Kyle Trask was named after Kyle Field, as most of his family has extensive ties, including his parents, to Aggieland. So interesting side note there. When you look at the way this Florida offense has performed so far, 600 plus yards and what I think we all would describe as a pristine effort against Ole Miss compared to how they performed against South Carolina, where there were a few blemishes on the resume. Against an Aggies defense, it's not going to find any respite here compared to what they dealt with last week when Mac Jones absolutely shredded them at every turn. But who knows, maybe a little bit of weather helps A&M. But when you're Mike Elko, how do you go about trying to slow down this white-hot Florida offense?
Pray.
That's not, you know, always listen, the best approach when it comes to winning football games.
I've been a little bit higher on Kyle Trask than most. I know a lot of people didn't necessarily believe in last year. The two Kyles have been on absolute fire. You know, Trask and Pitts are basically the talk of college football right now, and deservedly so. But the one thing that's interesting to me is the Gators' offense, from what I have watched and what the metrics indicate, the offense looks a little more balanced this season, right? The O-line is moving some guys around. Pierce and Davis are averaging over 5.6 yards per rush combined. Most of the damage is being done outside the tackles. Pierce has a 78% rushing success rate the first two games. So Trask is getting help from the ground game when they ultimately decide to run it, which isn't overly, which isn't too often. This game, to me, at least this side of the ball, will come down to A&M's defense being able to do two things. You know, get pressure on Trask, limit the explosive play. Last week, we saw the Aggies defense could only pressure Mac Jones on 20% of his dropbacks. He was just loving life back there. A&M also created like an abnormally low rate of havoc against Alabama. You kind of led me to this, Todd. A&M's secondary has talent, but I think they're really, really young. They gave up 7 big passes to Alabama last week. You know two things. Dan Mullen's fantastic devising game plans, and he's really good finding and attacking your weakness. He understands that passing is more efficient, and right now Florida's passing more. 13% more than the national average on first down, 7% more than the national average on second down, 21% more than the national average on third down. This is a passing team. He is going to attack that young A&M secondary. And I get that Trask has been fantastic no matter what, right? Clean pressure, clean pocket, under pressure, right? Does not matter right now. Trask completion percentage has been fantastic, 9% higher than expectation. But I think you still want to get after him. Force him to check the ball down. If he has all day to throw, it's going to be lights out. You know, you're looking at Trask right now, an adjusted completion percentage of 80% when kept clean, 135 passer rating.
Jesus.
A&M's defense needs to figure out how to get to him, force the ball to come out of his hands a little bit quicker. 4 or 5 yard passes aren't going to, you know, tear you alive. It's the big plays that you gave up to Alabama that will. So I think A&M needs to protect their secondary, keep things in front, get to Trask if you can. If he has all day to throw, they may hang another 50 here.
You're a lot more optimistic about A&M's ability to protect that secondary. I mean, this is a group that really struggled with eye discipline.
You know, Mac Jones in Alabama, that's a different animal, right? You got for three sure. pros there operating things in a fantastic offensive line.
I won't disagree with that. I don't know if Kyle Trask is the ultimate cure-all to try and allow the defense to get right game by any stretch of the imagination. But you're right. When you look at this Florida team, I mean, they're finding ways. Kyle Pitts providing an absolute matchup nightmare for his opponents. I think what's even scarier for the rest of the SEC, they figured out how to get Kadarius Toney involved last week as well. 6 for 84 on that side. We know how explosive he can be when he gets the ball in space. When we look at Jimbo...
Did you see that run?
I did not see it. I had read a little bit about it, but I didn't actually see it with my own eyes.
It was like a crossing route for like, I don't know, 7 yards, and then he just hit the speed burners and then was like a bowling ball kind of bouncing between like four defenders. The yardage there that he accumulated for the game was a little misleading, but he finally hit that big explosive play. We've been waiting for him to come out a little bit. If he can get going, just an added element to Dan Mullen's offense.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the talk through Florida was that, hey, look, we need to try and turn him into the 2020 version of Percy Harvin as that big play waiting to happen, not necessarily being the high-volume guy. So clearly promising there when you give Dan Mullen a new weapon. But weaponry has been a little bit lean, to say the least, for Texas A&M on the other side. I mean, this is a team still trying to figure out its identity in the passing game. Your leading receiver last week was Aeneas Smith, the running back, who leads the team not only last week, but overall in receptions this season. Kellen Mond, completion percentage below 50. You think he's got to use his legs. I don't know where Texas A&M goes, Payne, honestly, to find answers, even against a Florida defense that's really struggled, in my opinion, and has performed well below average. We just haven't talked about it because how good their offensive counterparts have been.
You're spot on. I think A&M's offense at this point is somewhat limited. The weapons outside probably aren't good enough in their current form to just consistently beat SEC defense, especially, you know, when plays absolutely need to be made. You know, situational football matters. So when you get Kellen Mond and his receivers in known passing situations, hasn't gone well. You know, when you get into the green and red zone and space is condensed and you absolutely have to have a play be made from a weapon, it just hasn't happened yet. I mean, you look last week, A&M had a better starting field position than Alabama. Their drive started at the 32-yard line. I think A&M did a good job having, you know, the same amount of scoring opportunities as Alabama did. 8 trips to the Bama 40 or deeper. But, you know, like I said, I think the problem is A&M's weapons. Once they got down there, averaged 3 points per trip inside the Bama 40 and beyond, couldn't make the big play to get over the hump. When A&M was forced into these known passing situations, just a 32% success rate because the receivers aren't good enough yet to uncover and open in these known situations. A&M having trouble creating explosive plays. If you remove the brain fart by Alabama's defense early in that game on the running back pass where the defender just decides not to push the running back out of bounds.
Just going to stop. Just going to stop on the play.
Yeah, just going
to. Can't give up.
I think he thought the guy stepped out of bounds, but Saban is going to have something to say about that this week.
Play but through the whistle.
If you remove that explosive touchdown, you're looking at an explosive rate well below 10% for A&M's offense last week. When you fast forward against this Florida defense, I think, you know, this is a matchup that will likely be the case all season, but A&M's offense, they're going to have to be efficient down to down. It means you have to play mistake-free football. You can't get behind the down and distance. You're going to have to be able to run the ball against the Gators so you can have manageable situations. The problem is right now when you look at A&M's offensive line, they haven't really created much space for running backs in the ground game. Just 2.5 line yards created by this Aggies O-line, 57th in the country in that regard. A&M's had 57% of their runs stuffed at or behind the line of scrimmage. The positive, though, and you kind of, you know, made mention of this, is you were able to at least move the ball on Alabama's defense, which I think probably will be, you know, top 20 or 15 defense again. In this matchup, you're looking at the Gators' defense. They've been susceptible, right? They've had issues tackling. Right now, the Gators have missed 40% of tackles, right? Their missed tackle rate on runs alone is 40%. That is a staggering number. And for perspective, the worst tackling team in the SEC last season had a missed run tackle rate of 33%. The average this season in the SEC, 25%. So you would expect probably Todd Grantham gets that cleaned up a little bit. We know there's a lot of turnover on the defensive side of the ball. But you're looking, South Carolina was pretty successful rushing at 60% rushing success rate. Again, you know, the missed tackles led to 64% of the Gamecocks' yards coming after contact. But A&M's got to get the ground game going. Hopefully, this is a matchup where you know, Spiller has a chance to get going, hasn't had enough touches or carries yet to this point. The other area where A&M's offense needs to be better is at quarterback, flat out. Like, we're not seeing it from Kellen Mond right now. And, you know, he's going to have to be better under pressure. We know Todd Grantham loves to send some heat. He likes to be aggressive. He has an attacking defense. Mond right now, 43 passer rating under pressure, 31% adjusted completion percentage. Mond has to make this defense pay. If they're going to blitz, there are going to be some opportunities here, obviously. We saw last week South Carolina's offense. I think they had some missed opportunities against Florida's defense. That's one thing. They still covered the number. You look at Colin Hill, I think he deserved a little bit better, especially early on in that game. South Carolina had 6 drops from the receivers in the first half, a couple crucial drops late in that game as well. Despite the lack of weapons, I get the feeling that A&M might be able to hang around here for a bit. They'll probably be able to move the ball a little bit on offense. Again, it hasn't looked perfect. The ground game hasn't been rolling. The weapons outside are questionable. But they were able to move it a little bit against Alabama, and I think the Gators' defense right now has taken a significant step back year over year.
Well, what's interesting about this, too, is you really look at A&M's schedule, and this is a massive swing game for them. If they can go 2-1, getting a split against Alabama and Florida, their most formidable opponents on their early portion of the schedule, the next 3 games set up a trip to Starkville to take on Mississippi State. We can call it a coin flip. A home game against Arkansas, a road trip to South Carolina. All of a sudden, you could be talking about Texas A&M being 5-1. Going into their finishing kick against Tennessee, Ole Miss, LSU, and Auburn, and suddenly things look a heck of a lot better than this team being 1-2 searching for an identity, with us left scratching our heads going, what's wrong with the defense, and is Kellen Mond ever going to be the guy, or does Texas A&M have to start looking towards the future, even in the midst of a pandemic-shortened schedule? So a lot at stake for a team that hasn't had a ton of success through the Jimbo Fisher era, beating top 5 opponents in their own building, but a chance to atone for an awful lot if they're able to upset Florida this weekend as a 7-point pup.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think you mentioned a couple of those teams on the schedule later in the season, LSU, Auburn. I think they're probably not as good as we initially thought about those two teams either. So the schedule might not be as difficult as you alluded to towards the end of the season, with some of those teams like LSU and in Auburn not being power rated as high as we initially had them coming into the year.
Definitely the case. 4 big games, 4 big game breakdowns is only Payne can provide. And of course, you can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And be sure to download the FanDuel Sportsbook to follow lines throughout the course of the week. You can see how weather impacts the totals. You can get ahead of the market in states where legal sports betting is allowed. Payne, we do have one final order of business, though, before we close up shop, the third college football podcast of the season, and that, of course, is to identify a best bet. Where do our travels take us this weekend in the lovely college football landscape?
Not a ton of great stuff on the board this weekend. The games are good. Not a ton of appealing games in terms of betting. Been a quiet week so far in terms of the market, other than all the weather totals. But let's go with another underdog here. Let's go 3-2-1. Go Tennessee plus the points. 12.5, 13 out there between the two. Obviously, try to get 13 if you can. Go with Tennessee as a dog here. Obviously, Georgia, big game last week. I am not high on Auburn. Haven't been for a while now. I think that first game against Kentucky was a little phony. All of a sudden, you see Kentucky struggle with Ole Miss. I just don't know what this says about Auburn. And then, you know, I think what we've seen from Tennessee is a steady dose of ground and pound. You have a ton of experience along the offensive line. You have a senior quarterback. I think they're going to do enough to stay within this game. And, you know, I like to see teams that outperform the market. And, Todd, one thing that we saw last week, a lot of professional money on Missouri. Tennessee blew through that. And I think this is a game, when you're listening to Kirby Smart, that he genuinely sounds a little concerned about. And he's not one to sugarcoat things. He's been open and honest. He doesn't heap praise upon opponents. And he said, just looking at the film, Tennessee right now is significantly better than Auburn. So, you know, I think the points here make some sense. We obviously have Alabama on deck for Georgia as well. So I like the spot here for Tennessee. Let's take the points.
29, 26, and 41. Do you know what those three numbers are, Payne?
29, 26, and what?
41.
41. I do not.
Those are the margins of defeat for Tennessee the last three meetings against their SEC East rival. So if there's a game on the schedule that this Tennessee team circled to announce that they're back amidst their eight-game winning streak, all the comments point in this particular direction. You get Georgia at the right time. You have to think that if Jeremy Pruitt's really got things headed in the right direction at Rocky Top, you're going to see it on full display. And that playbook, whatever they have, both on the offensive and defensive side, going to be completely unleashed.
Absolutely, no doubt. And they seem like they're playing with confidence right now. That's the big thing. And they've done very well on the highway. So let's go with Tennessee plus the points in this one. Again, grab 13 if you can get it. The current number, though, is fine at this point. And I just, you know, looking at our numbers, we make this a little bit lower. And the situation seems to be a very good one.
Tennessee Volunteers. Rock. Well, I don't even know the song. If I did, I would probably try and sing it Rocky Top one way or another. But good spot to go, especially with such a low total, the idea of catching nearly two scores. Let's get to that magic number of 17 for the Vols, and I think the rest will take care of itself. Any final words of wisdom, parting shots? Do you want to go on a quick rant before Florida State gets boat raced against the COVID-ravaged Notre Dame team Saturday night under the lights in South Bend?
No, that's it.
All right.
Poof. Back tomorrow with the NFL.
For Payne Insider, you can follow him on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Download the FanDuel Sportsbook to track your lines throughout the course of the week. College football best bet, the Tennessee Volunteers. Come Saturday afternoon, once the Vols win this game outright, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.